All participants, this conference is being recorded. If you have objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thanks very much, Kelly. Glenn, let's hold on the roll call for just a minute. I see that a lot of people are still joining. We'll just spend a minute or two going through the agenda and making sure that we're basically on the right course. This agenda is just about like last week's agenda. Most of the time spent talking about proposals with a good dollop of analysis team brainstorming at the end. I have three new proposals this week. I have the one from Afilias, I have the one from GoDaddy, and I have the one that just came into the list about an hour ago. A very substantive proposal from Volker, Michele, Stefan, and JC called the Open Registrar Proposal. So those are the three that I have slots. Do other proposal presenters want to take a slot in this first hour? And if you do, raise your hand real quick, and I'll take note of you. Otherwise, we'll basically divide the time between those three. John, you want to get in the queue for a discussion of yours?
Yeah, actually, Jeff Newman and I just circulated a combined version of both of ours together.
Okay. So we'll do the John-Jeff version. If that was the list, that would be really handy for your timekeeper because that would be 15 minutes each. Does that work for folks? Last call for proposal presenter slots.
This is Tim. I just joined, by the way.
Oh, great. I'm glad you're on the call, Tim. I've got a slot for you. That's terrific. Okay. I think that's our plan. An hour on proposals with a little 15-minute dab at the end for the analysis team brainstorming session. That leaves us a few minutes of slack to sort of play with. Glenn, why don't you go ahead and do the roll call, and then we'll dive into the Afilias conversation with Brian.
Thank you, Mark. Yeah, I will. On the call, we have Michael Connor, Ashley Jettison,
thank you
Thomas
much.
Barrett, Russlyn Satteroff, Paul Diaz, Jeff Newman, Kathy Kleinman, Christian Orman, Sebastian Bachelot, George Sadowski, Jara Karuska, Siva Mutasami, Mike Pelage, Jeff Eckhaus, Roberto Gaetano, Volker Greiman, Jonathan Frakes, Kathleen Olmer, John Nevitt, Brian Cute, Avery Doria, Scott Austin, Hazel Shaw, Tony Harris, Bodwan Chombi, Alan Greenberg, Barry Cobb, Tiro Mustala, Tim Ruiz, Richard Tindall, Nacho Amador, and for staff we have Kurt Fritz, Mike Zupka, Margie Milam, Liz Gaster, Glenda Saint-Géry, and Gisela Gruber-White. And for apologies, we have Michele Nalon, Ron Andrus, Cheryl Langdon Orr, and Vika Mitasani. Have I left off anybody?
Hello there,
and
Glenn.
Ken Stubbs has just joined the call. Thank you, Mikey. Over to you.
Thanks, Glenn. Folks are continuing to join the Adobe Connect room. I encourage you to do that. And with that, we're off. It's 5 after the hour, and Brian, I hand it over to you, and I'll keep an eye on the queue for you. You've got till 20 after. Hit it.
Thanks, Mikey. I'll try to be really efficient here in terms of time. I hope everybody's seen what we put forward as a proposal at Afilias. I doubt that much of what we put forward would have come as a surprise to folks who've been engaged in this discourse with us over the last God knows how many months. But I'm just going to hit the highlights of the proposal and obviously happy to take any questions on that. So moving quickly, we wanted to touch on the element of cross-ownership. And what we propose is an ownership cap of 15% in both directions, if you will, between the registry operator and the registrar in the one setting, and in the second setting, a 15% ownership cap between a back-end registry services provider and a registrar. We've made points in here as to why we think the 15% cap is meaningful. Most importantly, to minimize the real and perceived incentives to discriminate or favor one's own registrar in the TLD setting. The next question, acting as a registrar in your own TLD, should be no surprise. We call for the continuation of that prohibition, which we've done throughout the discourse. Next element that we commented on, with regard to equivalent access and non-discrimination, we believe that equivalent access and non-discrimination principles should apply in the TLD new TLD setting, and identified limited suspension of the equivalent access and non-discrimination requirements in three vertically integrated exceptions. The first one, an exception, is a single registrant. We that that was a model that was identified in the Cray report. It's an exception that a number of participants in the working group have put forward as something to be considered. We went along with a prior suggestion of a cap of 30,000 registrations for the TLD operator, but offered what we think is a bright line test as well, and that is that the single registrant should be able to distribute only to its employees. There's consistency with that in terms of the Cray report description of this category, but I think more importantly, for any of these exceptions, to the extent we feel strongly that there's any gray area around the rules of the road in terms of what the registrants do outside of equivalent access, and that needs to be defined. So we believe that an employee test is a clear, bright-line test. It's easy to prove whether someone is an employee of a company or not, and we that any other party outside that category, it should be treated as a sale to the public. Equivalent access should apply, non-discrimination apply, use of ICANN registrar should apply. The second exception, community TLD, again, we suggested that the registry should be able to act as a registrar in its own TLD up to 30,000 cap. Again, the issue of defining this category is important, further definition of what a community actually is, and with an emphasis on defining what a community applicant is for purposes of the evaluation by ICANN, the scoring by ICANN in the application review process, we think more work needs to be done for that exception category. The third exception category, we felt that PIR's proposal about establishing an orphan TLD exception, if you will, limited exception, merits consideration. We didn't suggest a specific numeric cap, but believe a cap is likewise appropriate for this limited exception. We also note and have heard that the NCSG has been noting concern for some time about the ability of smaller registries being able to find a distribution channel as a distinct concern. And so for that reason as well, we felt this was a category that merited consideration of the working group. And then lastly, the brand TLD. Again, this is mostly a call for further defining this category. It does tie back to some degree to the single registrant because in the Cray report that was a corporate TLD, and in trying to determine whether it can sell to its employees or a broader group, we think the narrower groups more is appropriate. But it begs the question, what does a brand TLD holder do with its brand? How does it market it? Does it market it just as a brand? Does it sell itself to the public more broadly? are the two different rules of the road for when they're selling to employees versus the category. Again, this is just a call or pointing out the fact that there needs to be greater clarity in this category. And I think that's the highlights of it.
Thanks, Brian. It looks like a queue is building. We'll start with Eric. Go ahead, Eric.
Thank you very much.
Maybe. Oh, there you go. Good. Sorry. Go ahead.
It's a delay to mute off. Brian, the question I asked on the list, I didn't see an answer to, which is what in the community definition is affiliates concerned about? What isn't there yet?
Well, it's if you look at the scoring system in terms of how a community TLD applicant represents itself as being representative of a community, what is the definition of that community? It's unclear as we went through this is particular to the scoring analysis as to how an applicant is able to hit the 14 mark. We think in terms of representation of who's backing that community, how the community is defined, there are some certain terms that I think you can make good faith arguments should be a generic TLD, but a community, you could create an argument that what's otherwise generic represents a community. I know some people use the eBay example in that regard. That's what we're talking about. We think that just further clarification about what the characteristics of a community are required so people have an understanding of, whether hitting that magic mark of 14 or 13 points is achievable.
Well, as a suggestion, since we spent a lot of time on this with Olaf Nordling, I think that's your primary staff contact to make clear the issues you'd like to visit. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, my question, or maybe more of a comment, is on the same topic of the community TLD, and the discussion that just took place, I think, is good, but what's being missed here is that there is no requirement for a community TLD to go through that scoring process. So the scenario is potentially that someone self-designates as community-based. There's no contention for the string, or even if there is, there's perhaps no selection or election of that evaluation, which both have to be true. And so potentially a community can become community-based TLD without ever having gone through the community evaluation process. So I just wanted to point that out to Brian, make sure he was aware of that. I think we've asked this of staff, and staff has confirmed it. And so if we're going to allow other types of exceptions, such as this, to community-based TLDs, then we need to reexamine the conditions under which that evaluation process occurs so that we don't open this up to gaming. That's my comment.
Yes, if I can, I concur with that. I agree that was an omission, that there is a two-step evaluation process here, and there is the possibility of an ill-defined community skating through in the first round and becoming a community TLD. So I concur, Tim.
Okay. Jeff Newman, I think you're next.
Yeah, I want to. I just wanted to concur with that and realize, Tim, that that's also an omission from John and I's proposal, not intentional, but that we'll be talking about. But I do agree with that, and certainly if someone's going to want to take advantage of this exception, then they do need to go through that community-based review. Absolutely.
Okay. Eric, looks like you're in for another one.
Yeah, thank you. Go ahead. Again, the slide to unmute. Prior to the issue of there being an exception, I don't think there was actually any real interest or concern about a non-community applicant masquerading as a community-based applicant, because absent an exception to registration, there just really was no incentive to try and fake it. Now, with an exception as a possible motivator for bad faith representations as communities, this does raise a problem which would not otherwise exist. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. Anybody else with questions or comments for Brian? Brian, do you have any final remarks? Then we'll move on to the next one.
Nope.
Okay.
Thanks.
Great job. Tim, you're next. And Brian was moving so fast, we're picking up time. So you have till just after the bottom of the hour. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I don't think it's going to take any... I won't need that much time. I'll just skip right to Section 1 in my proposal, and I'll just get to the nuts and bolts of what it is, I guess you could say, what we're proposing. What we're proposing is that, this is by we, I mean GoDaddy, that the 15% ownership limitation apply to ownership both ways, so similar to what Brian was just describing, between a registry operator or accredited registrar. Ownership either way would be limited to 15%, but that would also apply in relationship to the registry back-end service provider. Between an accredited registrar and a registry back-end service provider, there'd also be that limitation of ownership of 15%. If any amount of ownership, cross-ownership exists, then strict structural and administrative separation should be maintained. We're proposing that Recommendation 19 of the GNSL policy on new GTLDs be adhered to, and as a result, I would then abide by Section 2.4 of the May 2009 RAA, which the group says that they would abide by such requirements in any ICANN established policy. Then in Section 2, what we do recognize is that some level of vertical integration could be beneficial. We don't intend to imply with the Section 1 that we think it should never happen or that it's a bad idea. In fact, at one time we were completely on the other end of the spectrum. But what we've come to believe is that there hasn't been a cohesive, really thoughtful approach to this whole process, and that's what needs to take place. So in Section 2, what we're proposing is that that before that happened, that there should be establishment of a cross constituency, or actually a cross-advisory council and supporting organization working group that would be formed to really develop a cohesive and thorough plan for looking at vertical integration and then recommending how a test bed might actually take place. But before that happens, and perhaps starting even as early as the four-month communication period for the new GTLDs, that a broad public notice take place so that it isn't just the ICANN community and the upcoming GTLD applicants who are aware that vertical integration takes place, but that as broad a spectrum of Internet users, potential registrants are actually aware of this change in the marketplace. Once the working group is formed, the test bed has been decided upon, and it actually has been introduced. Then there would be a review of that within 1 year after the introduction of vertical integration, again preceded by a broad public notification, and then the working group could be reconvened to consider the results of that review and what the next steps in the introduction of vertical integration might be. And then finally in Section 3, we talk about mitigating registry failures, and this might also apply to some other limited potential problems, and that is that instead of looking at trying to form some process in advance to deal with the possible exceptions that may need to be made out of necessity, that those be dealt with after the fact. We have a precedence for that actually right now. some of these issues came up with .museum. There were issues with .name, issues with .pro that they've applied to or requested ICANN to make exceptions. And those have been dealt with in various ways, but we have some precedent that we're able to deal with some of these types of issues after the fact on an as-needed basis. And we've tried to pigeonhole or sort of label some of these things like, orphan TLDs or, community-based or single registrant. But we think that the spectrum of potential issues are much broader than that and impossible for us to really predict up front. So that in order not to delay the rollout of new GTLDs, dealing with them after the fact on an exception basis is probably more practical. So that's the proposal, and I'll answer any questions.
Thanks, Tim. Eric, you're up. Questions?
Thank you very much. Tim, thank you for a very well-crafted and readable proposal. This isn't so much a question as a I agree statement. Whatever went wrong with the original three STLD contracts back in 2001, we should fix those. But in retrospect, attempting to guess that the total space of things that can go wrong in the future is a lot harder. Than fixing what we know is wrong. And we can do that, again, with the least amount of risk-taking. So thank you.
Thanks, Eric.
Jeffrey, you're next.
Thanks. Hey, Tim, it's Jeff. I sent this email to you. I sent it just before the call came, so I don't know if you had a chance to read it. So I figured I'd just ask it on the call, and hopefully you maybe can answer it. So I know that, and this is for you and maybe Brian as well since he's on the phone, is that about the .me domain, which we know is a ccTLD, and I was saying I believe it's either owned or managed by, a consortium of affiliates, GoDaddy and the government of Montenegro. And, personally, I think it's been a great success. One of our companies, our affiliated companies, NameJet, just did a big auction on it. I've seen it on Facebook, all these other pieces. I think it's been incredibly successful, and I don't think anybody has had any thoughts about gaming or issues. So in your proposal, you stated that you feel there's a potential, there's a potential harm to registrants if the ownership level goes above that 15%. So maybe if you could give me, maybe if I'm wrong about the ownership of the part, you could clarify that. But if it's not, could you describe GoDaddy and affiliates' experience with .me and what was to prevent any harm or gaming and how you're able to accomplish that without those 15% caps?
Sure. Well, first of all, in terms of the 15%, Jeff, there's a historical basis for it. We're all familiar with that. First of all, keeping it at a 15% level, we think, still allows for investment in the new round, registries to investor and registrars and vice versa. And that's important, that there be, capital available, investment available, people are able to place their bets, but do so in a way that doesn't create an ownership position that really incents the registry to discriminate in favor of its controlled registrar or vice versa. So it's really trying to avoid that scenario. And the fact of the matter is, if you go back in history, even where there was a 15% ownership cap, and I'm speaking to VeriSign and Network Solutions, there's still among registrars, deep, deep suspicion that there's some form of favoritism going on behind the scenes. There's a recognition that, as a financial matter, by owning a 15% stake, that there's certain financial and revenue benefits that roll up to the registry, and always concerns about cross-subsidization. So even with the 15% cap in the past, it hasn't completely eliminated elements of concern and suspicion between among registrars. But we think it's very important that it be in place. With regard to the .me name, as you said, it is a CC, and in responding to CCs, as we know, the rules can be different, and governments can require certain structures and certain approaches to managing their own their country code names. All I can tell you about, in terms of affiliates, is that we have, a long structure of having registrars owning parts of the company. And, you know, we feel that we've got a very strong track record and have been able to manage in a very neutral and appropriate way those ownership percentages, those relationships. And that's basically my comment on Afilias.
So,
Tim?
Okay. I don't know, Tim, if you wanted to, I don't know if you wanted to respond to that, to the question, or I'm just because I understand that, you know, there's, you know, there, we're saying, hey, let's think about things going forward. What I want to say is, hey, let's, and I think maybe, I don't want to steal, I guess it was Volker's, the other presentation, but saying there's a long history of non-discrimination, non-gaming in the CCTLD world. And, you know, I think, I believe so in the, you know, in .me, which as it, while CCTLD is being marketed, you know, as open to everyone, that we haven't seen discrimination. I personally, you know, have not seen it, haven't seen any issues, and it's been wildly successful. And I think that has larger than 15% co-ownerships by registries and registrars. So I'm just trying to reconcile how on one side you're saying, you know, how we reconcile, not necessarily you, but how we reconcile on, we'd say it's a long history of, you know, non-discrimination in both sides. How do we reconcile that, that we've seen non-discrimination in both sides, in both CCs and GTLDs?
Tim, you want to speak to that? You may be on mute, you lucky dog. Give it one more try.
Hello.
And by the way,
there we go.
Wait, sorry.
Can you hear me?
Say one thing.
Hang on, Jeff. Hang on.
Wait,
Jeff.
I just
Tim, I can hear you now. Go ahead.
I just wanted to add one thing, Tim or Brian. If you want, if you don't want to answer now, you wanted to add answer to the list. That's fine because it is sort of short notice, so that I wasn't expecting like an answer this second. So if you want time to think about it or to respond to the list, I'd be, that's perfectly fine.
No, I'd like to respond. I guess I evidently I was being muted by the conference call, the conference management, because my line was noisy. At any rate, I think Brian, you know, explained things pretty well. You know, in reality, I think that we kind of, you know, we're where we are with .me as far as protections are concerned, maybe to some extent by accident, because we, you know, I mean, we originally went into the .me proposal process on our own. But, you know, the way things worked out, we partnered with Afilias on that, which is well known, and a local company called MeNet based in Montenegro. And I think as a result, because of who Afilias is and their experience with this and just the way things ended up being structured, not due to any experience we had or any, you know, brainstorms on our part, but it just fell out that I think the protections are very very much in place. Afilias has had experience with that. You know, keeps us from making any stupid mistakes. But on the other hand, too, it's different in that there was a set of rules that applied to .me registrations that was produced by the government prior to anybody being involved. Those are a part of what we need to enforce and restrict what we can do. And the government is still actively involved. So much of what we do or things we want to proceed with or whatever still has to be vetted with the government. So they're still very much involved in the management of the TLD. And I think rightfully so. We offer it. It's marketed much like a GTLD, but the government is cautious about that. They think, you know, that's the way they want to proceed, but they're cautious in that they don't want to go too far with it. So it's a little bit different in that respect because it is a CCTLD. There's a similarity. But what I don't want to say is that from this experience, we do think that ultimately some amount or some level of vertical integration could work. What I think we're saying, and I tried to make clear in the proposal, is that I think there hasn't been any cohesive look at it. There hasn't been any thoughtful approach to it, or a cohesive and thoughtful approach to it, and that's what we're concerned about, and that we don't go through all these ad hoc studies and processes, and then come to some quick decision that later bites us in the butt or that we regret later. That's what our concern is.
Thanks, Tim. We have two more folks in the queue and about four more minutes to get through them. So, Jeff, you're up, but try to be brief.
Okay, I will. And I was going to save this for the CC for the next or for the open registrar proposal, but since it was brought up, I don't think it's doing us justice to compare us to ccTLDs at this point, because for every ccTLD that, and there are some that are listed on this list, that allows integration, there are just as many ccTLDs that don't. And they, for example, United States is one of them, .us, will not allow any percent integration or cross-ownership. So it's 0% at this point in time. It has a very strong statement in their RFP as to why it hinders competition to allow any kind of cross-ownership or vertical integration. So that's in the .us RFP alone. And I will also say the Colombian .co, which is launching, also has a very strict cross-ownership and vertical integration, I should say anti-any cross-ownership or integration issue. So we could easily delve back and forth between the different ccTLDs that have it, that allow it, that don't allow it. But I will say that there are many ccTLDs that are much different than the gTLDs. It's comparing apples to oranges, and many ccTLDs, while there are some ccTLDs that are not heavily regulated by their governments, there are others like .us and Colombia and others where the government has to approve every single action, much more regulatory in nature than than some others that are out there. And without, I'm not bad mouthing any out there. I'm just saying that certainly I could tell you the amount of regulation in .us I believe is much greater than ICANN exerts over its gTLDs. So at this point in time, until we can do those studies on both sides, until we can figure out what makes it work, what doesn't make it work, I think going down the path of saying, well, it works in some ccTLDs, it's not going to cut it for me personally. So that's all I have to say at this point.
Thanks, Jeff. We've lost Brian. Tim, do you want to respond to that, or shall I go on to Pelage? I may have lost Tim again due to the mute. I'm asking the conference call operator to be pretty aggressive on muting people because we've got so many people on the call. So if you find yourself on mute, star 6 will get you off. Tim?
Can I ask Jeff to ask me again? I was muted and being talked to at the same time here as I was trying to listen to Jeff, so I'll be honest, I did not quite get everything he said.
Actually, Tim, it was more in support of what you were saying, that you can't really compare the ccTLD market to the gTLD market, and until the studies can be done between the country, you know, why certain ccTLDs do one thing and others do another, that your approach and the approach advocated by a number of proposals is the right one.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think that, you know, another point I didn't make was that, you know, in the .me situation, you know, it's somewhat unique in that these were three, well, if you count the government, four, you know, previously unrelated entities that came together in a venture. I think that's much different than some considerations that are being made. But anyway, I think Jeff's right that it's difficult to make that comparison right now.
Okay. Pelage is in the queue. Ken Stubbs is in the queue. We're at 35 minutes. I'm going to go another – I'll go till 40 after the hour. Go ahead, Mike, but try to be brief.
Can you hear me, Mikey? Or do I
have to... Yep. Hear you just
okay,
fine.
Okay, good. No star 6 required.
Right
just,
on.
Two statements. That I think are interesting to note. The first is I would like to support Jeff's statement about the blending of CC and gTLDs and point back to the ICANN board discussion in 2006 when they called for a full market analysis of the domain name space, in which ICANN has failed to do to date. This has been specifically noted by the GAC and others within the community. So perhaps ICANN could do the full market analysis so we actually can engage in a fact-based discussion of this topic. point number two, we heard about how the U.S. government has exercised control in their approach, as well as the Colombian government with strict separation. But then we've also heard how the DAEM with the Montenegro government has adopted a much more lax approach to their sort of co-ownership and integration. And the point I'd like to raise here is those people that have been critical about the MMA proposal and how it goes to government competition authorities to help provide safeguards and regulations, we've just heard from both Jeff, Afilius, and GoDaddy that the governments involved in those respective CCTLDs actually do work in protecting consumers. So I just find that an interesting sort of point to note. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Ken's dropped off, so I guess that's it. Tim, any final thoughts before we move on to the next, and then we'll move on to the open registrar proposal?
No, that's it for me. Thanks, Michael.
Okay. I don't know who's speaking for the open registrar one.
Hello?
There's four of you who submitted it. But whoever you are, you're up. And you can go till about 10 minutes to the hour with my usual sloppy thing keeping folded in. So, Volker, are you the presenter?
I'm trying to be, yes.
Oh, it's so good to hear your voice. I can hear you just fine. Go ahead.
Okay, I have a little cold, so it might be a bit difficult to understand me, but bear with me for a couple of minutes. I'll try to be brief in this. Having read all of the proposals out there in the open, we felt that it was necessary to make our point clear as well. As registrars dealing in the GTLD world as well as the CCTLD world, we have made a lot of experiences, and we simply do not believe that vertical integration or co-ownership necessarily is the evil that is sometimes made out to be. In the past, ICANN has had many remedies to abuses and misconduct by registries or registrars, which are always implemented after the fact. And we wonder why this shouldn't be possible in this view as well. So we are proposing that 100% co-ownership or vertical integration is possible in the new GTLD world, especially since many new GTLDs will be like CCTLDs in every aspect except for being not of a country but of ICANN accreditation. We see this as the easiest proposal. It needs no exceptions. It has a very strong, if we implement a very strong but flexible framework of rules that govern how these vertically integrated registries and registrars have to act, then we would be able to allow all kinds of registrations or TLDs that have been proposed and that had exceptions proposed for them possible without needing to go into detail at every level. We do not see that competition authorities are a solution because, at least in Europe, competition authorities will not look at companies when they start with 0% market share and 0% market ownership, but only after they become something of an entity that would interest them. They simply do not have the time or the resources available to check every proposal that is coming onto the table for possible violations, and I firmly believe they won't even consider the option of looking at these proposals from a competition angle. We do believe that audits are possible and necessary, but not on an annual basis as in the proposal by Demand Media and others, but only on the case as needed, or if there is criticism or complaints about conduct of a certain registry. In that case, audits should be implemented, and if a misconduct is found, stiff penalties should be imposed, of course, but we believe that the after-the-fact remedies are much more effective than implementing than implementing, how to say it, a rules that prevent certain TLDs or proposals from even getting off the ground from the start. I think that's most of the basic things of the proposal to be concise here. We've put a bit more detail into this written form, but I think I should be open for discussion here.
Terrific job, Volker. Thank you very much. I'm looking for a queue for questions for Volker. This proposal, by the way, for those of you who are not reading the list every minute of the day, came fairly close to the start of the call. So the proposal has hit the list. And I encourage everybody to take a look at it.
And I apologize for that.
No worries. Pelage, is your hand up from last time, or is this a new one? I'm going to go to Eric, and if your hand is really up, I'll go to you next. Eric, go ahead.
Thank you. Volker, would you be adverse to rewriting your proposal so that the proposal itself, whatever it is, clearly stated and not commingled with argument and counter-argument? It's actually somewhat difficult to figure out what your proposal is, and I'm sure it can be stated simply. Thank you.
I think we can do that, yes. I will propose something for the group.
Okay. Jeff Newman.
Yeah, I was actually waiting for someone to propose it. Now we have both ends of the spectrum. We have one proposal, I think, that was initially submitted by the registry stakeholder group, which is probably the strictest, and now we have the other end of the scale, which is the loosest. So I think I thank them for proposing it, so now we can get to somewhere hopefully in the middle.
Christina, go ahead.
I would just second Eric's request because it was difficult to read. The two questions I have are, I'm not really quite sure how to reconcile, on the one hand, the position that audits are unnecessary against what I think is a proposal for increased compliance monitoring and penalties for violation of equal access provisions. So then the other question I would have is that with regard to the SRMUs, what is your group's position on the registry imposing objective criteria that would apply equally to all registrars interested in carrying the TLD?
Well, obviously, as registrars, we believe in equal access for all registrars. Some factual inequalities must probably be there. For example, if you have a Zulu registry, they won't probably be able to service you in French. So if you're a French registrar, you better learn English or Zulu. But apart from those factual inequalities that are just based on the TLDs that are proposed, we believe that all registrars should be able to become accredited in every new CCTLD and have the same opportunities to register domains for their customers as the vertical integrated entity is. And, of course, if there is found to be lacks of judgment or compliance in this case, then the penalties should be imposed after an audit finds these to be true.
But I thought one position, or at least maybe I misread it, but I thought one part of your proposal was that audits were unnecessary.
Audits on an annual basis, as prescribed by some of the proposals we have seen, are unnecessary. Audits after the fact, after a certain complaints have been made, then they would be part of the penalty system, compliance monitoring and penalty system. So we would have audits in case of complaints by co-registrars that the vertical integrated entity isn't playing by the rules.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Ken Stubbs, you're up. You may be muted if you are. Try star 6. One more try.
Can you hear me?
There you go. Now you got
I'm sorry. I got
no worries.
People there.
No,
I've got a couple of questions here. First of all, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, so please correct me if I'm wrong. But what I get from what you said is basically there would be no requirements for audits. There would basically audit is an oversight function. It seems to me that there's no clearly an indication of any clear oversight function defined here. It's almost like, well, we can't have oversight because it costs too much money to comply with it, and we're just getting started, and that's just too much of a burden to impose on us. And really, what we're saying is when we have a problem, then we'll deal with it. The only problem is that in some cases, and I use Register Fly as an example, by the time you discover you have a problem, it is so material. The effect can be somewhat devastating on both the registrants and the community. And I believe that you have to have an oversight function to be able to allow those kind of issues to be surfaced early enough on, and the oversight function has to be properly managed. And there have to be penalties that allow you to deal with it early on. One of the biggest problems that ICANN had in the early stages, and I'll never forget, I think it was Louis who indicated the frustration. The only way they could deal with problems with the registrars initially, all they have is the death penalty. That was it. There was nothing in between, and there was a lot of frustration. Also, the contracts were limited by the relationship that ICANN currently had had with Network Solutions, which at that point in time was still a registrar tied in with the original registry. So I guess what I'm really saying is I don't think you can afford to have a situation where the community has to wait until you have a material problem to deal with issues. And if you don't have some sort of an oversight function, you may not be able to recognize it early enough on to deal without significant impact. Thanks.
Okay, let me just put my or our thoughts to that in perspective. We have, maybe as a bit of an aside, put that concern into the proposal at the very end in section V, miscellaneous, .C, compliance monitoring and penalties. We do believe that compliance monitoring is necessary, but not as a standard auditory, not a standard audit system that is repeated annually and will create a large financial burden for many of the smaller proposed registries and new TLDs, which would effectively lead to them not being able to be commercially viable. We believe that registrants and co-registrars will watch 100% vertically integrated or co-owned registries very closely and will complain to ICANN or any so designated authority and will then be investigated at that point. And at that point, when the investigation takes place and finds anything to be wrong with that, then certain penalties could be imposed, which could be graded along the severity of the problem that it was found in the end. We do believe that vertical integration is possible, and I think we should, as a working group, find the middle ground as to what penalties should be imposed on such registries which are found to be in violation, and as well as how to best do the compliance monitoring. We did not want to impose any of our views as to how this is best done because there's many people that have many different different impressions or ideas on that subject on this list, and I think if we all cooperate on that effect, then we would find a very good solution to that. This is why we put that as an assigned as a basis for discussion, if you will.
We're right at the end of the time. I think I'll let Jeff Newman get in one last thought. Scott, you were sort of popping in and out. Are you back in for...
I am back in, but I didn't know if this was the time. I didn't know if we were raising questions for each individual one or overall when we should ask those kinds of questions.
Oh, that's a good point. Let's save the overall one for the very end. That way we kind of march through the ones that we've got in front of us and then jump in again at the end, Scott.
I'll try and keep track.
Point. Yeah, well, I'll try and keep track too. Thanks. Jeff, is this quick? Can we
it's a question for Volker. I guess it's I've heard you say a couple times, and I saw it in your paper, that without vertical integration or full cross ownership, that TLDs won't be commercially viable. So I guess my question is, what TLDs do you find have been launched with these restrictions not commercially viable? And then the second question is, what type of innovations do you see that you can only do by allowing cross ownership and vertical integration?
Actually, I think that most in most cases, different approaches might be possible. I just think that it should be the proponent of the new TLD to decide on how to best operate his system. I also think that in many small communities, registrars will not be willing to pick up that that TLD just because of the small numbers to be expected, and will not have established registrar base like, for example, CORE has, where they have a registry operator owned by, I think it's 20 different registrars who will be able to pick up a new TLD very quickly and very easily. In such cases, it might be very beneficial for the registrants and the registry as well to be able to get accredited as a registrar as well and sell direct to their customers, because how big is Zululand? How big is a small town in the middle of Mexico that wants its own TLD? And it has a very defined target audience for their domain names, and those domain names will maybe not be reached by the established registrars, or on the other hand, registrars will simply not pick up that TLD because they think they won't make any money off of it. And it might be better done if they could sell direct. Just as one example.
Okay. Any other questions for Volker? Any final comments that you want to make, Volker, before we move on to John and Jeff?
I think we've had everything that we wanted to propose discussed here. So I think I'll just open the floor for the next proposal, and the rest can be dealt with on the list, I think.
Terrific. Thanks, Volker. John and Jeff, since this is a combined proposal, can I allocate you a slightly shorter period of time, like 10 minutes, and then we'll get to Scott's question, and then we'll get to the analysis?
Each or 10 minutes total?
10 minutes total. Unless there's something really dramatic that you need to tell us about.
I can describe the proposal, and we'll see what kind of level of questions are there.
Yeah.
We've combined the elements or certain elements of both of our proposals into one and tried to merge it, added a couple more elements, and try to reach a middle ground position. So essentially, we stick with the 15% cross-ownership limitations that we've discussed in the past, 15% or control that have been out there, and the reasons for and against those have been widely discussed, so I won't go into that considering the time frame. The exceptions to the 15% are as follows. One, essentially, if you're not selling names in the affiliated registry, then this doesn't apply, and that distinguishes our proposal from some of the others that are out there. So essentially, an entity, a registry operator, can apply for a certain string, and then as long as their affiliated registrar doesn't sell it, it's not a problem. The other three exceptions are, based on comments from various folks, or the single registrant TLD, and we limited that to, I think like Brian mentioned, to employees and the entity itself and agents. Essentially, no third parties, though. The community application would be an exception up to 30,000 names. And again, I agree with Jeff and Richard and others who mentioned that you still have to get the 14 points to make sure it's a true community applicant. And then the orphan registry, where they make a good faith showing that they can't get traction in the registrar marketplace if And again, I think Tim pointed out that this hasn't existed before. I think every TLD has at least three or four or five registrars selling their names. But in the case that with new TLDs, with an explosion, or I wouldn't say explosion, with an enhancement of the number of TLDs out there, perhaps this might be an issue, so we leave a safeguard for that. And then, finally, we have this in place for an 18-month period. So we would adopt the current STLD agreement language, which essentially says, with ICANN approval, you could go above 15%, and the criteria would be these three exceptions in the beginning, and then after 18 months, just like Tim Ruiz mentioned, you know, we get together and we could get advice from competition authorities, we get advice from economists if we want, we continue our work, but we could expand it after an 18-month period. The other elements that we added, we continue with the same use of registrar distinction. The other new elements, however, are if there's a restriction on the ability of an affiliated registrar, ICANN accredited registrar, to sell the names, that should that restriction should continue with any reseller. So you don't have a backdoor way for essentially if a registry operator applies for .web and they're a registrar, they can't sell it on their registrar accreditation, but they could do it indirectly through another. It kind of defeats the whole purpose. So we put a restriction on that, again, for 18 months. And to Brian's point, we don't want to incent a registry to favor an affiliated registrar. And if they're not selling the names, there could be no favoritism. And if they're not selling it indirectly through a reseller, there will be no favoritism. And then, again, on a back-end registry, to make it comparable, we say, if the back-end provider isn't dealing with policies or setting prices or selection of registrars, then they can sell the names through an affiliated registrar with certain criteria, you know, protections that are in place that we've talked about, that there's a strict separation, strict controls of it, no data sharing or sharing of confidential information. I would have annual certifications to that effect, and we talked about annual audits and a sanctions program. So we would have those in for back-end providers and for resellers after the 18-month period. How was that? Did I make the time?
That's spiffy.
All right.
How about that for a technical term? We have a little bit of a queue building. Jeff Eckhouse, you're first.
Thanks. Thanks, John. I got this a little while ago, so I'm still reading through it, and I'm just maybe you guys can explain. I'm kind of confused a little bit about the term control and how I can understand the ownership, how that's measured. How maybe you can give me a little bit more. I hope maybe if I'm the only one, you don't have to, but about how control would work and how it's measured, and because I'm not really clear about the control part.
Sure, that's easy, Jeff. That's just a safeguard. If you could conceive of a situation that could be gamed, that if you own 5% of a company but you control the entire board, for example, and you do that through a contract, that you actually control that company even though you only own 5%, or
right.
You only own 5%, but you're entitled through contract to the entire revenue of the company or something like that. So it's just a way to avoid gaming.
Right, but who would, I mean, two things. One is controlling, you know, it says the direction of the management or policy. So, you know, part of it is you could say, hey, some large registrars can control how certain registries or TLDs are operated because they control it on what they want them to do, or... You know, that's just conjecture, and I know – I'm just saying, how would that be measured? How would anybody say, oh, they do control it or they don't? Is that a possibility? I'm not really clear on that.
This is Jeff Newman. John, can I jump in?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, I think it's a good question, Jeff. It's but it's one that actually has been tackled a lot in other areas of the law, and unfortunately I can only speak for the United States and have some familiarity with a few of the countries in Europe. But there are, like in the U.S., for example, the Securities and Exchange Commission, which looks into these types of issues all the time. They do have objective tests, and they do have objective criteria. Certainly, if people bought off on this principle, we could easily bring some of those objective criteria back in here, but it requires an examination of bylaws, it requires an examination of articles, it requires, for example, material contracts for certain portions of the business that are being done to be disclosed at least to the regulatory body. Here, I guess the closest thing would be the ICANN. So there are a number of ways to look at it. I know it's, for those not familiar with this area, it may seem daunting task, but it's really, it's almost down to a science in those other areas. And so assuming that there's buy-off on the principle, we could easily provide more objective criteria.
So, sorry, just follow up quick. So you would propose that, I know in the other areas like the SEC, they have a full, huge organization that manages this. So would ICANN be the regulatory body that checks on controls and would have to be monitoring that at all times in your proposal based on your ideas?
Well, that it's part of the application. You would submit your, which you would anyway, your bylaws, your articles, your financial due diligence, and your material contracts to provide, or your contracts to provide material portions of the services. So in that respect, you know, if there's any services that are provided by an affiliated entity, you have to disclose that, and you have to disclose the contractual terms. And, yes, that would be part of the review process, and that would also be something that would be checked up on in the audits.
Okay. Palage, you're next.
Thanks. Mike Palage here. And, Jeff, just another shout-out referring to your security and change and other governmental bodies that seem to have objective criteria that businesses rely upon in conducting businesses. Again, just wanted to point that out. Getting back, though, to my original question, which was the 18 months, we've been according to sort of my calculations, I think we've been discussing this issue for over 18 months now. So what happens, and again, Jeff, I think you said it was 18 months from the time of execution when the clock would start ticking. Nevitt, do you agree with when that clock starts, or do you have a different time frame, and what happens if we reach a stalemate and we're not able to have some type of decision on flexible criteria outside of that 18 months?
Yeah, no, from the day of the contract is definitely workable from my perspective. And, I think you have to stick with the status quo unless we come up with or ICANN comes up with a better system after community input and the kinds of discussions that Tim Ruiz referred to. The ICANN could get advice from the competition authorities as well. So, that could be part of a study.
So I guess what happens is, and again, John, when you were speaking, you talked about in 18 months ICANN going to the experts. So what's preventing them from going to the experts now? And again, as a follow-up to my original email to the list, what happens if an applicant goes to an expert right now, a competition authority, that gets a business review letter that says, yes, you can do this? You're basically proposing that notwithstanding a national competition authority saying that there's no issues, you somehow believe that ICANN's bottom-up consensus process could prohibit that legal business from taking place. I mean, is that's correct from your proposal, right?
No, it's not correct. I mean, you assume a whole bunch of things in your statement, so I mean, we can
parse. Okay, so let's break it down.
Hey, Michael, I'm gonna push you a little bit. Let's take this one to the list. We're getting real tight on time here. I'm sorry to cut you off, but
one more
round of discussion, and then let's draw a line under this one and move on. So you go one more time, and then we'll call it a day on that one. Okay.
Okay. A competition authority says that there's no problem with the proposed joint ownership, 100% joint ownership. That's so somebody goes to a competition authority, gets that approval. Would they be able, under your guidelines, within before 18 months or after 18 months, to do that without ICANN community saying yes?
I think any kind of application, if they have input from a competition authority, that would be obviously very important to ICANN in evaluating a request for approval.
And this is Jeff. But, Mike, and this is what I try to say in my email, may not have done a great job. A competition authority is but one input into the full situation of what we're talking about. We're not only talking about, for example, Department of Justice looking into whether a merger would affect competition. We're also looking at other types of effects on consumers, and there are other authorities within a government and, frankly, other considerations that are outside of the government that are within the ICANN community that need to be considered. So just because someone receives a note from a competition authority saying we don't care at this point, which is really all they get, they never say we approve. They would say at this point nothing's come to our attention to raise red flags. That is not the be-all, end-all statement to allow everything to go forward.
Okay, I'm going to draw a line under this. I know it's tasty, and we need to get it onto the list. Ken, you're next. We're running a little tight on time, so try and be brief.
Okay, can you hear me all right, Mikey?
Yep, hear you
fine. Okay, fine. I have a suggestion. I think it will make it a little bit easier for the group to deal with time, structure, and so forth. Why don't we try to define a starting point for these periods as being the time that a domain is commercially available to the general public? That way you don't have to worry about 18 months from when the contract's signed, 18 months from when they go on the route, 18 months from sunrise or whatever. It would make it much easier for us, and you would remove an awful lot of these questions, even on posts, as to what do they mean by this time period. So maybe we can start drilling down on some of these issues just to get them out of the way so that we can concentrate on the real meat. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken. Scott, is this your general question or is this one for the Jeffs?
No, I think I've heard enough. I'm not sure that I could hold any more information in my head discussions and still have a meaningful question. I'm gonna try and attempt, though. I do like John Nevitt's piece. I'm assuming that's JN squared. Is that correct?
Yeah.
John Nevitt, Jeff Newman.
Okay, if it's a combo, that's fine. Because it's for the first time in my experience on this list anyway, I've seen some detail put into words that I think are key, and whether it's and that being control. And I guess the question I have, and also let me make a brief comment on competition authorities. We have a Securities Exchange Commission, and we have a Department of Justice, and we have an FTC, a Federal Trade Commission. All of those bodies have very specific roles based on expertise, but yet all of those things are impacted by what we're working on here. So I think that's where we're running into some of the troubles of trying to be all things to all people. My question in listening to all the proposals today, and I applaud the one Volcker's also in the sense that it's sort of free enterprise, and I think that's great. I'm surprised that some of the ones coming out of the United States haven't been more free enterprise. But the bottom line is that all of these anticipate audits. They all anticipate that these percentages somehow are going to be audited. My question to those who have the experience, whether it's Newman or whether it's people from GoDaddy, have they ever been audited under this 15% that exists under the current regime? And if so, what are the documents? What are the things that are looked to verify that? Because I think that may go into our new definitions. And I think that the Nevitt proposal is the closest I've seen to hitting the nail on the head with that.
This is Jeff Newman. Can I answer that?
Sure, go ahead.
Sure. So in the ICANN world, there have not been any audits that I'm aware of for Neustar. I will say for Neustar, though, we have very strict annual audits every year by in the telecom industry with our contractor for 5% ownership. I posted an example early on and when this group started that Neustar is prohibited from owning more than 5% of a telecom service provider, or no telecom service provider can own more than 5% of us. There's all sorts of rules on who can serve on the board. It's really detailed. And we do get audited every year by a top five firm, accounting firm, and we have to submit self-certifications initially, and then the audit firm actually comes in and randomly picks out a ton of documents and material contracts and everything else to look at to make sure that we live by those requirements. I'm not saying that it needs to be quite as extensive as that and or extensive as that, as I noticed someone has posted. But certainly, you know, looking at key corporate documents is not that great of an expense. Things like bylaws, articles, board resolutions, and material contracts for portions of the service are really not too many, and in the registry line of business would not be really onerous at all.
Thanks, Jeff.
Okay, if I could make one comment to that. I think that because as many of us operate with UDRP proceedings and operate on the Internet with clients who are always wondering who's out there, because of the fact we're in a virtual world, I think it is very important that we do have ways to audit, and we do have ways to, without a complaint, make sure that there is some oversight by some agency that we trust. And with that, I think that I'll the only other comment I would make that is that John Nevitt's piece, where he also talked about registry operators or service providers, that's the first time I've seen that addressed, and that seems to me that that's a way to create a subterfuge of ownership. In other words, a lot of these TLDs will be owned by a NewCo, and that NewCo may not mean anything in terms of ownership of a registrar, but in fact, that NewCo may be created by or owned by either the owners of a famous registrar or the famous registrar itself.
Okay, Scott, thanks. I'm going to draw a line under this chunk of the agenda. We have 15 minutes left to spend. I'm going to completely change our gears now and put Barry Cobb, our fearless leader of the analysis team, on center stage. This is a repeat of last week. I want to spend a little time brainstorming around the questions that the analysis team has for the group, but I'm going to leave it to Barry to lead that part of the discussion. We'll go till just about the bottom of the hour and wrap up the call. Barry, are you on the phone, I hope? You may be muted.
Barry seems to have disconnected.
Ah, too bad. Did he just disconnect, or has it been a while?
I just did now. I'll just check with the operator. Just bear with me for a second.
Okay. Well, I'm going to kick it off, and Barry can join when he rejoins the call. Ah, there's Barry. I hear his voice. Back on again. Barry, I just put you on center stage. I don't know how much of my intro you got, but we're into the analysis team portion of the call, and I thought I would just throw the ball to you and let you lead us through about 15 minutes of brainstorming around the questions that your team might have for us.
Okay, thank you, Mikey. I apologize. I'm not in a closed office, so I probably have some background noise. I just wanted to start off by saying that the sub-team met briefly last week. There were about six of us that joined the call. We basically talked about our approach for the, first and foremost, the schedule of goals for the sub-team, and then the conversation carried forward with our approach. We reviewed through kind of a first draft, or I wouldn't even call it a draft, but an initial concept that basically outlined our approach, and it kind of took the approach of looking at different proposals based upon attributes. We talked that basically that would probably be very hard to accomplish. And so our discussion kind of took a turn towards taking the approach from looking at the stakeholders. So, for instance, what does this proposal mean from a registry perspective, a registrar perspective, registrant slash consumer perspective? And that's basically where we had finished. We didn't get very far in terms of the overall framework for which we would conduct the analysis yet. We have a meeting scheduled after this working group call today to continue our discussion, and then we'll be meeting again hopefully early next week. Our goal is basically to meet at the beginning of the week. By close of by Friday of this week, we hope to have our first draft out to the larger working group for review. We'll meet, I think it's approximately 5:30 or 5:40 within our sub-team. By 5:07, we'll submit our second draft out to the working group for review, and we hope to be able to wrap this up by May 10th if everything goes well. So right now, our approach or what we hope to discuss in this upcoming call is to continue our discussion around the framework as applied through the lenses of the stakeholders, and probably a dependency for us to consider is the work being done. My goodness, I can't remember his name. He was on the yes, thank you. And take a look at what that charting exercise will be coming up with. For now, that's not all I have to offer up. I invite anybody on the sub-team to offer up questions. We didn't really get to corral around any major questions that we wanted to pose to the larger working group. And I myself don't have any at this particular time, so I invite others on the sub-team to ask the larger working group. Thank you.
Thanks, Barry. I'll take a cue on that. Pelage, is your hand up from long ago, or is this a new question? And meanwhile, not a new question. Given that the analysis team is maybe not quite ready, maybe rather than chew up time on a call where every minute is a person hour, I'll draw this one to a close. I'll look at the queue for just a second to see. To give you a brief update, Mike Zupke has come up with a first pass at a matrix that compares the proposals by concepts. So he's built a giant grid, basically, where he's listed a whole bunch of concepts down the side and then attempted to determine which proposals contain that concept. And I'm very excited about it, but it's one of those things where I think it's fair to let the proposal advocates take a look at Mike's draft before we publish it to the list. So during the course of this week, if you're a proposal advocate and Zupke's trying to get a hold of you, please respond quickly. And the quicker we can get that first round of editing done, the quicker we can get his draft to the list, which will not only help all of us, but it will also help the analysis team know which pieces aren't yet covered. So that's a quick advertisement for speedy action on Mike Zupke's stuff. Jeff, I see your hand up. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if you were going to close the meeting after this or whether you were just saying closing this part of the discussion. I just wanted to ask a general overall question. But
go ahead. We've got a little time.
Yeah, it was just on timing. Like, what's the plan? How are we moving this forward? What's the...
Our main deliverable and our main deadline is sort of the deadline at the end of May for documents headed to Brussels. The GNSO is going... We have a slot on the GNSO working session Sunday morning, I think. Glenn told me, and I've forgotten. But as a result, we need to get a deliverable...
Sunday morning.
Sunday morning. Thanks, Glenn.
Yes.
We need to get a document ready.
9:40 to 10.
And so that's the sort of most major deadline. The framework that Zupke has started developing, I think, will help us fairly quickly identify the major concepts and the major, essentially, clusters of consensus that we've got in the group. The ideal would be that by about a month from now, we could have consensus around each of the concepts that's in there. Whether we'll get there or not, we will at least have snapshots along the way. And as you've sort of heard on this call, there's an emerging sense of sort of best-of-breed language from various proposals that we may be able to stitch together into that, et cetera. And so I'm, as your process-type guy, still pretty comfortable with the progress we're making. The conversation on the list is fantastic. And one of the things I've started doing is using the list as a searchable knowledge base for questions that I have. I'll throw words at the list and, you know, in my email browser and get very rich slices of conversation about all sorts of topics. So that's kind of the story, Jeff. You know, I'm feeling like we're pretty much churning along on track. I invite other comments, but, you know, that's the world as Mikey sees it at the moment. Ken is next.
I have a major question, but I want to defer because Roberto, your co-chair, is in there, and let's put me in after Roberto.
Oh, he is. Yeah, we'll let Roberto talk. Roberto, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to jump the queue, but anyway, I wanted to add a couple of things. Maybe I'm stating the obvious, but when we are talking about deliverables, I think that we have a range of possible results. I think it's clear by now, it should be clear, that we are not going to have one proposal among the one that is presented that is going to be chosen and presented as a result of the working group, but that those proposals will be just the source of items that we are going to discuss and put together. And I think that our minimum is to find some of these items on which we have consensus. For instance, I don't know, the cross-ownership 15% or whatever, where we have a consensus and present that as a consensus of the working group, even if that is not a complete proposal that will solve once and for good the vertical integration, the cross ownership, and all the other items that have been points that have been raised. So I think that this is important because we can go on bit by bit and come to Brussels with whatever we have in terms of consensus of the whole working group as an initial part for the board to make decisions on.
Thanks, Roberto. Ken?
Thanks, Mike. Can you hear me?
You bet.
Okay, first of all, it's interesting. Christine and I almost hit the same button at the same time. This is a question for Glenn, and then I need a follow-up. Glenn, how much time have you budgeted for the GNSA Council session on VI on Sunday? You know?
Ken, I was asked by Stefan to put out 45 minutes.
Okay, then I'm going to respond to that. We have somewhere between 45 and 65 people involved in a work group that will end up creating probably into the thousands of email letters. And if we're going to end up making a presentation to the Names Council and only budgeting 45 minutes for this, I consider this to be a somewhat Herculean effort. Knowing the way that the council works, the next opportunity to respond to that, please correct me, Christina, or anyone else who's on the council, there's no real formal working sessions during the week unless I can create one, and in fact the council would manage that one. I'm terribly concerned about trying to get any sort of a product through any major part of any process in Brussels with 45 minutes. I see Christina's responded indicating that she felt that we needed much more than 45 minutes. I would hope, Mikey, that you and Roberto and anyone who's on the ICANN staff who's on this call would seriously consider taking a very close look at the enormity of the body of work that's been done here and the amount of time that needs to be taken for deliberation in Brussels, please. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken. Duly noted. We'll take a look at that. Eric? You may be muted,
thank you.
Eric. There we go.
Now I can like Ken, I have a process issue to raise. We have 10 people in the first poll response out of the 70 or so. 15 in the second. In spite of the number of emails written, there is a substantial number of the participants or volunteers who are non-participants. So my question really goes to, before we get to Brussels, what does consensus mean in a group in which we have essentially half of the participants who don't participate and the other half, which could be evenly divided into now 10, I think, different advocacy positions? Thank you.
Eric, I'll send you the $50 after the class is over. That feeds into something that I'd like to encourage, and that is that we do have a very substantial number of members of the working group that haven't said a word. And that may be because you're bewildered, or it may be because you're still making up your minds, or something. But it's important that you speak up. I think one of the most difficult outcomes would be a situation where people, you know, we are clearly a group of people that's working very hard. You've heard that in several contexts. And it would be a tremendous disservice to have essentially a sudden arrival at the very end of the process of a very disruptive component of the conversation. So if you're silent, please consider speaking up if no other way than through the poll. That's one of the main reasons that the polling is going on, is to draw in comments, thoughts, positions from people who find it difficult to speak up either on the phone or in the email conversation. One of the comments that came back on the poll was, perhaps if it were a private poll, we would get better participation, and I'll take this opportunity to say that this is consensus, and in consensus processes, it's very important to know who holds which opinions. And so a private poll may work fine for majority rule kind of decision making, but it doesn't work very well at all for consensus. So I just want to second that point that Eric made, that we need to, especially those of us who haven't said much, you need to make the effort, because otherwise I think Roberto and I will be faced with some very difficult decisions if right at the end a bunch of people speak up with a very contradictory point of view. I'm going to let Sebastian talk first, Ken, if that's okay. Sebastian,
no problem,
go ahead. Sebastian, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. As one who is not talking a lot in this arena, I just want to underline that the problem is that there is so much mail that in one sense you are very happy with that, but I am not unhappy with the fact that a lot of people, or some people, write a lot of emails. That means that there are some discussion, but for me, and I guess for some part of the working group people, it's almost impossible to read everything and to find the time and to find the ability of reading everything. And I start with the idea of, if I read the proposal, it will be okay, but now there is no just 4, 5, 6, now it's 10, even more proposals, and it's really very, very difficult. I am hoping that work prepared to have a matrix will help a better participation, because it will allow comparison between the different proposal and not discussion on one-to-one proposal, and I hope that will be great. At the same time, I just want to underline once again that we are in an international environment, and that it's always difficult for non-English native speakers and you have to take into account then when you add acronym to some difficult English word to a lot of text, it's we are dead. We are outside of the discussion. And in the same time, I think. We need a face-to-face meeting. I am not sure that something on that is not written on the mail. I didn't read it, but and even if it's not possible to be done prior to Brussels, I hope that on Saturday it will be possible to have a face-to-face meeting and with some time to work. I know that it will not deliver something for the Brussels meeting, but I will hope that it will help for the next phase of the work of the group after Brussels, because it's less costly and less difficult to have people participating to a face-to-face meeting on Saturday prior to the Brussels meeting. And my last point is that I do think that you do a very good job, Mikey, with a survey, and I would like to ask everybody to participate at least to the survey, because I think it could give a good idea. I am not very happy that we have just 15 people answering and 60 plus participants to the working group. Still, it's not enough, and it's not enough for the result, but it's not enough to reward the work done by Mikey on that issue and the other. Then I would like to urge you to do that. And maybe, Mikey, your survey you just give the result could be still open for the other participants to try to have at least, I don't know, more than half of the participants to answer your question, because this seems to be a very good way to go for the next phase. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sebastian. I will send $50 to you after the meeting as well. The survey is going to be repeated every week. What you have all lived through is the alpha test and maybe the second alpha test of the survey. I think as the matrix evolves, that also will refine the structure of the survey, and that very quickly the survey and the matrix will become structured pretty much the same way. And we'll do one every week. And so expect on Friday morning to get an email from me with a link to a new survey each week. I'm sure that the structure of it will continue to evolve. The structure of the matrix will continue to evolve. And basically, all roads lead to Roberto's vision at the end of May, that we will have a series of ideas and a strong sense of which ones we agree on at that time. And that's basically what we're going to carry forward into the meeting at in Brussels. I certainly understand the issue with email, and that is one of the reasons that we're doing the matrix, is to get it to the point where you don't have to follow every single one of the 1,100 plus emails to be current on the conversation. So thanks very much, Sebastian. Ken, I think you're last on the list, and then we're a little over time, so please make this brief, and then we'll wrap up the call.
Mike, I'm going to just echo a post that Avery had about everybody monitoring and dealing with these type of meetings in their own way. So have a nice day.
Okay. Thanks, all. Great call, and we're over time, so I'm going to cut it right off. We'll see you this time next month.